found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Heels and Wheels is back. We're raising money for Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. Join us for a ride, lunch, and a souvenir t-shirt and a donation to the cause this Sunday. Registration is just $40, and the money you help us raise helps women in our community who may be underprivileged, uninsured, or underinsured. All women, all riders. Registration is at 8:30. Kickstands up at 10 a.m. Roll into Ventura Harley-Davidson in Camarillo this Sunday and join the cause. Visit MariaSanchezShow.com for event details and register online right now. Join us this Sunday morning for the 8th annual Heels and Wheels, a women's motorcycle ride in support of Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. Proudly supported by Ventura Harley-Davidson, Grand Marshal Maria Sanchez, and News Talk 1590 KBTA.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and thank you so much for joining us and the Maria Sanchez Show, heard here every weekday morning live at latalkradio.com, channel 2, and then later on demand and for download at mariasanchezshow.com, as well as on iTunes and latalkradio.com. Thank you again for your downloads and for your clicks and your views. We do appreciate it. It means a lot to us. We also are open to suggestions about events, about topics, about guests. So please, if you have something in mind and you haven't reached out to us, please do so. My contact information is everywhere on the website, the blog, Facebook, etc. So like us on Facebook if you haven't already. We've got a packed morning for you. It is Friday, July 12th. Our first guest is an epic fighting commentator and television host, and tonight's epic fight is in San Diego, and he's going to share his thoughts on Anderson Silva's loss last weekend. So if you are an epic fan, stay tuned, and if you aren't, you're going to learn something. We also have a guest who's going to be speaking with us about integrity. And what does that mean to be in integrity? And then finally, a homegrown story. We have Molly Flippin visiting with us. She was born and raised in Ventura County, and she is now dancing with the Los Angeles Ballet and her illustrious career in her young life. So that's our guests. In the news today is some pretty exciting news. And I, you know, one of these days we're going to stop saying the first. But Janet Napolitano, of course, the Secretary of Homeland Security, is said to be named as the next president of the University of California system. This appointment means that the 10-campus system will be headed, here we go, for the first time by a woman in its 145-year history. Now, of course, Napolitano, who's a Democrat, was appointed by President Clinton as the U.S. attorney in Arizona, and then she won elections as state attorney general and twice as governor. She was governor from 2003 to 2009, and then President Obama named her to lead Homeland Security. She's only 55 years old. She attended Santa Clara University and was its first woman valedictorian before she earned her law degree at the University of Virginia. She is unmarried. She has no children. She underwent a mastectomy for breast cancer in the year 2000, just weeks before she addressed the Democratic National Convention. So I've sent this news story to one of my brothers because I'm a product of the UC system, and so are both of my brothers, as is one of my sons. All four of us actually got our degrees from the University of California at Davis. And so I was like homegrown, and my brother Patrick was like, wow, can you believe her career? And she must have been governor at 45. How depressing. I'm like, I know, do the math. So the UC Regents are expected to approve her nomination as their 20th president during a meeting in San Francisco. UC has an annual budget of 24 B as in boy billion, 230. I'm not saying that right. 191,000 faculty and staff, 5 medical centers, and 3 national laboratories. Her cabinet salary is about $200,000. The current UC president, Mark Udoff, makes almost $600,000, so that'll be a nice bump for her. He is going to be stepping down after 5 years as UC president in late August, in part due to some health issue. He plans to teach law at UC Berkeley. So congratulations and right on for the UC system. As we speak, human rights activists and attorneys arrived at the airport in Moscow for the first meeting of its kind with NSA leaker Edward Snowden. He asked to meet with them to discuss what he called threatening and illegal behavior by the United States to prevent him from gaining asylum. This meeting is being held private. It is not open to reporters. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have confirmed that they received the invitation, which was sent yesterday afternoon. And Russia is getting increasingly impatient with his presence there. They're supposedly hosting finance ministers from the G20 next week, which includes the United States. And obviously, they'd like this wrapped up before that happens. So it'll be interesting to see what comes about with that. We have a couple other stories about health and wellness to share with you in between our guests. One of them has to do with how we use our phones in the bedroom, having intimate contact. So we're going to connect with Carlos Kramer, who is the epic fighting commentator and television host. He will be joining us in just moments.
Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning, Carlos Kramer. Thank you for taking the time to visit with us this morning. Are you commentating on tonight's epic fight in San Diego?
Yes, I am. It's my pleasure to be here, Maria.
Thank you so much. What is EPIC, E-P-I-C?
Epic Fighting is a fighting organization that's located in San Diego. And as you know, San Diego is a hotbed for mixed martial artists in general. And it is the, you know, finest amateur show that you will ever see. It's a breeding ground for all of the future professionals. So we get UFC fighters and trainers, managers, owners of gyms, and anyone looking to, scout out some real great talent and future pros to watch. They come to Epic Fights, and it's held at the Four Point Sheraton in Kearny Mesa.
And when you say mixed martial arts and Epic, are they one and the same?
No, Epic is the name of the fighting organization, like a UFC. Ultimate Fighting Championship is the name of that organization. And mixed martial arts is what they do.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's a variety of everything into the ring. Same rules as the UFC. And it's really the best show in town, and people have said it's way better than any of the pro shows that they've seen as well.
So what constitutes mixed martial arts? What are the rules?
Mixed martial arts would be two guys that enter the octagon, and they go to battle. They're going to be able to do anything. They can punch. They can kick. You can wrestle. It combines jiu-jitsu. It combines kickboxing. It combines all of the martial arts together, but there are no there are very strict rules in that there's no eye gouging, there's no hits to the crotch, there's no kicking an opponent when they're down on the ground and that you're standing. So there are some very severe rules that they keep this a sport, and that's what's kept it the fastest growing sport in America.
And they do not wear gloves or shoes, correct?
No shoes, and they do have gloves, 4-ounce gloves that protect their knuckles. So it is pretty much, you know, once you're in there, it is go time. And the good thing about mixed martial arts as well, if a fighter is unable to defend themselves at any time, that's when the fight is stopped. Unlike boxing, where you can see someone take repeated hits over and over and over again, if in mixed martial arts, if the fighter loses that ability to defend themselves, and you see them eyes rolling back in their head, or just unable to defend themselves at all, the fight is stopped.
And so that is at the discretion of, is it a referee or umpire or what do you call them?
Correct.
Who's in the ring?
It is at the discretion of a referee.
And or can a contestant, if you will, opt out, tap out themselves? It doesn't have to come from somebody else.
Correct, yes. We say tap, snap, or nap. And if you tap on your own, then you are you have ended the fight on your own. If you don't tap, a lot of times, and someone has you in a chokehold, you are going to take a long nap for a little while.
In other words,
so,
you're knocked unconscious.
Yeah,
you're knocked
it
unconscious.
Is in your discretion.
When someone's got you in a chokehold, and if you don't tap out, then you just they actually make you go unconscious.
Yes.
Okay.
You will lose consciousness, and then the referee will stop the fight, and you'll regain consciousness in about 8 seconds or so.
And then the snap is bones?
Snap is bones, yes. So, one of the rules, what I usually, and a lot of the other fighters usually go with is that if someone has you in a chokehold, they're going to try to ride that out as long as possible. But if someone has a joint, an elbow, your ankle, a bone, that's something that you're going to want to tap quicker on because the risk of injury is far greater.
Well, not to mention then your recovery time.
Exactly.
So if you've broken something, obviously that puts your career back for a little bit.
Exactly.
So Carlos, the average MMA fighter, what are they like? If somebody's listening and think, okay, I'm athletic and or I box or I do martial arts in general, what's the kind of the requirement or what skill set do you need to have in order to become a contender?
Oh, man. You know what? This skill set has evolved so much since 1993 and Hoist Gracie coming in into the UFC and really being the pioneer with the Gracie family. The skill set is amazing now. You know, back in those days, you could just be able to do jiu-jitsu or be a wrestler or a boxer and win your matches. Now you have to be skilled in jiu-jitsu, wrestling, Muay Thai, which is kickboxing, straight boxing as well, and even some forms of karate. So it's amazing the evolution of the sport. Truly, you have to be comfortable on your feet and on the ground in order to be even considered to be involved in the sport.
So are there other communities that have epic fighting, or is this indigenous to San Diego and unique?
There's other fighting organizations all around the world, but EPIC is indigenous to San Diego. It is led by Jason Stewart, who's the CEO and founder, and he's done an incredible job. To any of our listeners, if you ever wanted to come out, all you would do is go to www.epicfighting.com, and you can get information, tickets, the whole bit. And then myself, Carlos Kramer, look me up. And I'd be happy to show you around the arena as well.
So is EPIC televised?
EPIC will be streaming, and I'll be commentating the fight. So if you went to epicfighting.com, you can see how to pick it up streaming, and that starts at 7 o'clock tonight. We've got 11 fights on the card, and they are including a women's bout as well. So with the advent of, the new women's champion, Ronda Rousey, women are really gravitating to the sport, and actually they put on quite an amazing fight, and a lot of times they're more entertaining than the men.
And what do they wear?
They wear the standard gear, the shorts and the shirt, and they're ready for battle, just like the guys.
Well, because aren't the guys topless?
The guys, they are topless, or in amateur, they will have a camo tight lycra shirt. So it's the same for women.
And the gals wear like a sports bra and then the shirt?
Correct.
Okay, because I've never seen them fight. And then briefly, share your thoughts on Anderson Silva's loss last week. And if folks don't know who he is, please give a background and then about what the heck he did.
Okay. For our audience out there, Anderson Silva is the reigning 185-pound champion, considered the greatest mixed martial artist to ever walk our planet. 7 years he has been undefeated. It's a reign of 16 fights, 10 title defenses, went into a fight on the other Saturday night against Chris Weidman, who is a very talented kid, but not in his same stratosphere. Anderson from Brazil seemed to have lost complete focus, started clowning around in the ring, doing a lot of his Muhammad Ali antics, and allowing Chris to be in the game, and actually was giving his chin to Chris Weidman to hit. And Chris Weidman caught him and knocked him out, and Chris Weidman is the new 185-pound champion. Brazil is very, very upset with the outcome there, as well as a lot of Anderson Silva fans and a lot of fans of the UFC and the sport, because they felt he disrespected, the true honor of being a mixed martial artist, and he had superior talent, and that went to waste. So it's a good lesson for a lot of fighters, especially young fighters out there.
Has he done any post-bout interviews?
He has, and, the latest report as of 3 hours ago is that now he wants a rematch.
Yeah, but has he explained his behavior?
He said that he, that's kind of the way that he trains. It's the way that he fights. And if you look at some of his past fights, he does have that rope-a-dope Muhammad Ali attitude to him. But, you can't drop your hands on anyone. I mean, a kid in high school, if you give your chin to him, mm-hmm. and say, hit me, can knock a man out. So, mm-hmm. you can't do that. These are some of the best fighters in the entire world. So, for me, I was very disappointed. I was shocked, angry. But you're going to see a better Anderson Silva, and you're going to see a great rematch come here in about 3 months.
And I would imagine Brazil isn't taking this lightly.
No, they don't take that lightly at all. And I'm very close with many Brazilians because I do jiu-jitsu myself and ingrained in that community. And they're not happy at all. Strangely enough, I will be at a seminar that Anderson Silva is giving on Sunday at Atos Gym, which is Andre Galvão's gym. And I'll have more to report then on what he says. But they are definitely not happy, and they look at it as a sense of embarrassment that he lost in that regard.
I was going to say, because it's almost a religion for them, right?
It really is. And you know what? To them, they don't care as much win or lose, kind of like the Japanese fans are as well. It's whether you left it all out on the table and that it was an entertaining fight. But if you lose due to the fact of you clowning and not that the other guy is better than you, that's where he's getting a lot of disparaging comments, hate mail, things of that nature, and justifiably so right now. He did it in front of millions and millions of people.
Unbelievable. So, you know what? I love the fact that it's now you have intrigue. You had a 7-year undefeated career, and then now he has to start all over again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. So, Carlos, we can watch and listen to you tonight on epicfighting.com at 7 o'clock Pacific time, and that's an 11-fight card, you said, including one women's bout?
Correct.
And we'll put your contact information up on our site when we post the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Maria, anytime, and appreciate it.
Of course. And that's Carlos Kramer, Epic Fighting commentator and television host. And he is hosting tonight's Epic Fights in San Diego. And so if you didn't know, now you know a little bit about that. We're going to contact our next guest, which is Claire Knowles. She's going to be speaking with us about integrity, and we will be with her momentarily.
The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
We're waiting. Oh, call failed. We'll try it again. So what happens here is the studio contacts our guests and then patches us together. I'm actually broadcasting remotely. My father turned 84 yesterday, and he has been in a wheelchair for over a month. So I came to help out this week. And as I was helping my mother this morning with him, my dad said, so the cycle has finally completed itself, that you from cradle to cradle, because my mom was having to change his undergarments and everything else, and she needed me to help roll him over and all. And it's one of the most amazingly humbling things, and he's taking it all in great stride, because it's cannot be easy to have, you know, you're here, you were independent, and suddenly everything that you need in life, you're dependent. And it's just, you know, the circle of life, it's really something else. So it's been my honor and my privilege to be able to help my mom and dad while I've been here this week. And then to be able to broadcast remotely has been awesome. And Ronnie in the studios at LA Talk Radio has been instrumental in the success of us being able to have the show this whole week from San Diego. So San Diego's also in the news because their mayor has been accused of sexual harassment, and it's making national stories. He says he needs help with his I don't know what his proclivities or addictions are, but I guess his girlfriend left him last week, and then three folks have stepped forward to ask him to resign, which as of this morning, he's not. So, Claire, are you there?
I am here.
Hi, Claire. Good morning. We've had a couple of technical difficulties, so thank you for being patient with us as we work our way through that. Appreciate your time. I know you're on the East Coast, so good afternoon to you, Claire. And before we get into lights on, I wanted to speak about the topic of integrity in general, because integrity, I think, is subject to interpretation. I know what I know it to mean, but I don't know if there is a universal definition. So if you will share with us what you think it means, and then we'll go from there, please.
Absolutely. And integrity, you're absolutely correct, Maria, it is difficult to define. You know, some people acquaint it with honesty or trustworthiness, yet most of us can really recognize it in a person because we naturally tend to respond to that person with our personal best. You know, a study was done not too long ago, actually with middle school children, and they were asked what are the qualities that a person who had integrity would be? You know, how do you react to that? And really interesting, because what their answers were things like they're true to their word, but consistent in their behavior. They admit their mistakes. They're able to listen to other points of view. And if there's a problem, they're able to confront issues and still be civil and okay with it. And if something's really wrong, they're able to go to the source of the problem with their concerns. And I thought that's really interesting because in that same study, and conversely, they ask those same people about a person whose behavior isn't trustworthy. In other words, behavior that you would consider to not, a person who you would consider to not have integrity. And they asked these children, what does that look like? And what they said was, they're people who break their promises. They say one thing and then they do another. They're inconsistent. And they leave others not knowing what to expect. And they may mean well, their intentions may be honorable, but they just don't follow through. Or they have a habit of actually backbiting or going behind a person's back. They aren't very truthful. And the bottom line was they just can't count on them. And I thought that's an important awareness. You just can't count on them.
I find it very difficult to believe that middle school students would have that depth.
Yes, because people can feel it. And you know, let's face it, when we're growing up, assuming that we have a parental element around us, you know, we are either held accountable or we're not. And I think that's very interesting. We're either enabled not to have to deal with things, and people see it. Children see it. They do.
Now, where do you think morality falls in with the integrity discussion?
Well, I think it's very much a part of it. And I think probably one of the best sources for that, Maria, would be Stephen Covey in his book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I won't go into all of that. I certainly could recommend that to anyone to read because there's a whole area in there that he speaks to about being principle-centered. And he calls that the character ethic. That you really, and that the character ethic is really based on some fundamental principles. And it's those principles that really govern our human effectiveness, how effective we actually become in the lives that we want to lead. And he lists some of those principles, and among them, integrity and honesty are two of the very cornerstones of the character ethic. And of course, there's others in there, you know, of human dignity and service and things like that. So how does that fit with morality? I think that's where it is. We choose how we're going to behave. And there's always a consequence to behavior. I think if Dr. Phil was on your show today, that's what he'd be telling you. When you choose behavior, you choose the consequence.
And, of course, we're known by the company we keep, and I'm a big one about congruence, that words and actions have to be together. In fact, I default to actions over words because where are your toes pointed? How are you actually, you know, carrying yourself? Where are you going? Don't blind me with your words. I want to see it. I want to see it in action, and I want to over time, because people can change. Or choose to change, I guess, but over time we're judged by, you know, our consistency, if you will. And that, it's funny, Claire, because when you think about it, when you say somebody has integrity, I guess it is also, it's your history, right? It's not like you have blue eyes, because we can choose to be in or out of integrity.
Absolutely. Integrity actually is like an internal consistency, as of having that as a virtue. It actually could be regarded as the opposite of hypocrisy, actually. And,
yeah,
and I think it's interesting. You just keyed on something there, Maria, about its consistency. And I'd like to quote Tom Peters. He was the co-author of In Search of Excellence. And I think he actually said it best. And these were his words. He says, "There is no such thing as a minor lapse in integrity." I just love that. That's what it is. Yeah, it is your history. It actually is. And let's think about it. People that when you have that discussion of integrity is as integrity does, you know, there's a gentleman named Larry Winget. Maybe your listening audience has heard of him, and he's really a guru in personal development. But he always says these words when it comes to integrity. He's the one that made the quote of, "Do what you said you were going to do." But it goes beyond that. Do what you said you were going to do when you said you were going to do it, exactly in the way you said you were going to do it. And deliver what you said you would deliver, precisely when you said you would deliver it, in the way you said you would do it. Call when you said you would call. Follow up when you said you would. And I just think that is so key, because we all can see that. We all know when we've been disappointed by someone. And I think we also know that person is choosing that behavior. There's no one getting in that person's head and saying, "You have to do this." It's a choice, you know, that people make. It truly is a choice.
Which makes it actually empowering, I think, because, as I said, it's not that you're born with or without it. It's how you choose to live your life, the choices that you make, the rules that you obey or don't. In other words, your walk. So, but that's also the good news, is that if you have made choices before that haven't been in integrity, you can choose to change that.
You absolutely can.
And so that, I think, is the hope of this message, is that, when you look back over your life, there may have been some mistakes or some glitches or aberrations, if you will, and there's no time like today, like now. Like, let's move forward and make ourselves a promise. Because, again, words are great, but it's the actions that define us.
You are right on, Maria. There's an old saying, too, don't listen to my words, watch my feet.
Right, which I say, because sometimes I'll say, stop talking because your actions are deafening.
I don't need to hear it.
So, Claire,
each of us, go ahead.
I was going to say I would like to focus on lights on a little bit.
Okay.
And
well, Lights On.
Yes.
Lights On is a book that I wrote almost a year ago, and it is called Lights On, A Reflective Journey, and I'm happy to be able to share that it's an Amazon bestseller. And it's actually a compendium of articles, Maria. And they're articles written about leadership, about choice, about being anchored in our lives. There's some musings in there. It's about leadership. There's a lot about women and moving forward. And it's really about being the best that we can be in the time that we have on this earth. And I wrote it really for women, but it's not entirely for women, in that my husband, for example, says as men read it, they get to understand women much, much better.
So it's a little roadmap, huh?
Yes, yes, but it is a book that is intended to propel you forward, intended to move you forward with your lights on, to help you see where are you going, to ask the kind of questions that really are provocative to what is the clarity that you have right now, and how does that mesh with your life? Because you are the manager of your own life, and if your objective is to manage your life in a way that's going to generate the highest quality results, hey, and you're not doing a good job, then you might want to get on the ball, because let's face it, back to choice and behavior and all that, we can't fire our life manager because we're it. So if we don't like where we are, we have to assess that and determine where do we want to be and start that path forward. So the description of my book, Lights On, is really about illuminations to move your life forward. And so that's what it's about. I'm very, very proud of it, that it has done as well as it has.
And how did you start the process? That's one of my basic questions to all writers, because there is the adage that there's a book in all of us, or in each one of us, and not everybody puts pen to paper or fingers to the keyboard. So how did you do it, Claire?
The story goes like this. My background is 34 years with the DuPont Company in human resource management and labor relations. So all of my life was about solving people problems. And after I retired, I was asked if I would write a feature column every month for an online magazine, which I did, along with writing for Washington Woman magazine in D.C. And I was lecturing on leadership at a college in Florida, when one of the women came up to me afterwards and said, Mrs. Knowles, have you ever put everything you've written all in one place?
Mm.
And I said, no, I haven't. And I had brought a number of articles with me that were pertinent to the subject at the time. That was the start. And then it didn't take me long to find them, organize them, and then I met another person by chance that said, you've got to put this in a book. So I did, and I met a woman out of California who has a program called Write a Book in a Weekend. And I spent the whole weekend kind of closeted up with my articles and put the book in order and gave it about 2 more months after that to finalize things. And sure enough, the book was born. That's how it happened.
They also say write what you know. And so this was something that is organic to you because it's a life you've lived professionally and then subsequently, as you mentioned, at post-retirement. I also have a friend who's in the business. He's a writer in Hollywood. And he says 90% of writing is rewriting.
Oh, that's true. As I said, the weekend was putting together articles I'd already written the next 2 months.
Right.
Just bringing them up to where even better quality.
So, Claire,
I'm just so pleased.
We'll link to your site so that our folks can, when they download the podcast, they can, also get in touch with you. And before we conclude our conversation, can you talk about how you've donated proceeds of the book to certain entities and why?
I certainly can. When I did the book launch, which was in December, I really felt that because this book is about illuminating women and about empowering women, I chose the YWCA because it's a national organization for women, and I belong to it in two places because I am a snowbird. Mm-hmm. But I really felt strongly that the model and the tenets and the vision for the YWCA is not only to eliminate racism, but it's to empower women. And my book, Lights On, is exactly that. It is about empowering women. So 50% of the proceeds of this book during that entire book launch process went to the YWCA. And it was so important, really important for me to be able to go to the national headquarters and to two YWCAs in the Western New York area and another one in the St. Petersburg, Tampa area, and be able to give them the checks of those proceeds and to be able to put those pictures on their websites. And it, I mean, that's what this is about. This is exactly what it's about, empowering women.
Excellent.
Move forward with their lights on.
Excellent. Excellent. I love your message, Claire. Thank you again for your time this morning. Continued success, and love to stay in touch.
We will do that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Claire Knowles, and the book is Lights On, and our conversation was about integrity, which is a slippery slope sometimes if you don't know where you're headed. We're going to connect now with a local good story, Molly Flippin. She's joining us. We're going to connect with her shortly.
Meals and Wheels is back. We're raising money for Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. Join us for a ride, lunch, and a souvenir t-shirt and a donation to the cause this Sunday. Registration is just $40, and the money you help us raise helps women in our community who may be underprivileged, uninsured, or underinsured. All women, all riders. Registration is at 8:30. Kickstands up at 10 a.m. Roll into Ventura Harley-Davidson in Camarillo this Sunday and join the cause. Visit MariaSanchezShow.com. For event details and register online right now. Join us this Sunday morning for the 8th annual Heels and Wheels, a women's motorcycle ride in support of Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center. Proudly supported by Ventura Harley-Davidson, Grand Marshal Maria Sanchez, and News Talk 1590 KBTA.
Thank you so much. Please do join us. The Heels and Wheels ride is this Sunday. That's July 14th. And if you haven't registered, it's $40. That includes the ride, a t-shirt, lunch, and a donation to the Community Memorial Hospital's Breast Center, which helps underprivileged women in need. And if you don't ride a motorcycle, you can also follow along in a car. And we have Molly Flippin on the line. Molly, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Morning.
I'm so happy
to hear you.
And your story. And if you would just give us a little bit, first of all, how old are you, Molly?
I'm 25.
25. And my goodness, mm-hmm. what you've accomplished in your short life. That's young to me. So you started ballet at 7 years old, and then mm-hmm. at 12, you began to do more intensive programs, which you received scholarships for. So take us through the life of a young ballerina and then a ballerina at your age, please.
Yeah, so when I was younger, I mean, it was after school was the only time I had to train. So I was right after we were let out, I was in the car going and training until late at night every single day. And then during the summers, I would audition for these summer intensives that each company had around the country. And they would offer these programs to train you for hopefully, you know, for your future in a ballet company. So it's a great experience. And so they're usually 6 weeks, and you would train there and work with some of the best people in the country. So it was a really great opportunity. So every year I tried out for different places, and it was a great experience. And then I went to the Rock School in Philadelphia for a year-round program, and then ended up getting a job with a company out there in Philadelphia. So now it's all that training really helped set me up for my day-to-day life in the companies now. So it was quite a journey.
And Molly, what is the audition process like? You have to prepare a piece. How many minutes does it have to be? Does it have to do, you have to do certain things?
Yeah, I mean, so we have a technique class every day. That's just how ballet is. Whether you're a student or a professional, it's just to work on your technique and to get in shape and stay in shape. So we have it every day. So the audition is basically the same thing. It's a ballet class that everyone is used to. the person in charge will give combinations, and but usually there are hundreds of people attending this audition, so it's very competitive, especially when you're trying to get into a professional ballet company. 300 to 400 people will show up, and you're fighting over, you know, one or two spots in the company. So it's very, very competitive and intense. But the more you do it, the more you get used to it, the easier it becomes.
And so, when you joined the Pennsylvania Ballet too, how old were you?
I was 18, so I was just out of high school when
wow.
I joined.
And then that you joined the Los Angeles Ballet in about 3 years ago, right?
I did, yes.
And what was that like? It's almost triumphant. You've come home, if you will. I know you were born and raised in Ventura County, but mm-hmm. we abut one another.
yeah. No, it was wonderful. And it was only the company that I auditioned for was the Los Angeles Ballet. I just really wanted to be back here. I mean, it is home to me, and I grew up here, and my family's here. And it was a great experience being back east. I was there for 6 years. So it was great to be somewhere else and to experience that. And to come back here, and I appreciate Southern California much, much more. So it was a great, great transition for me, for sure.
So, Molly, we have all of these, let's say, rumors about what it means to be a ballerina, including some mm-hmm. feature films that have been fairly prominent mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. The anorexia and the backstabbing and the competitiveness and the ageism and all those sorts of things. What's a day in the life of Molly Flippin?
I mean, of course, you're going to find those things anywhere you go. It just, those stereotypes are around for a reason, but it's a very small amount of people. I mean, with my company, every day it's a family environment, you know, where we've all sacrificed so much to get to where we're at now, and we're supportive of each other, and it's a very warm environment. We're all there. I mean, I personally go in the morning, and I focus on myself and what I need to do and how can I be competitive with myself. I don't focus on other people, what they're doing. It's trying to better myself. But it's good that, for the most part, especially in my company in Los Angeles Valley, it's a very supportive environment, and you don't run into a lot of the typical stereotypes that much day to day. So it's just a lot of hard work and preparation. That's the majority of it.
So Molly, share with us what your day is like in terms of what does training mean? What is your diet like? What mm-hmm. routines do you go through? And does it depend on the season?
It does somewhat. I mean, we had the last program we did was a George Valentin program, and it's very intense and very physical. So you do need to be in the best shape and eat healthy. It's not about dieting crazy. I try to eat very healthy and think of fueling my body instead of just, you know, trying to look the best, and just think of giving it fuel. Every day we have a class in the morning, like I said, and then our schedule changes daily, but we have rehearsals until 4 o'clock at night. And then when we're in the theaters, we're there until very, very late working on studying the ballets and everything. But generally class in the morning and long rehearsals and just trying to, I do some Pilates and yoga on the side to stay in shape and cross train a little bit to prevent injuries. And we have a great physical therapist who's always working with us. And that's a huge thing with ballet dancers. You get injured so much, so you have to really take care of yourself.
Now, how long in terms of a period of time do you rehearse for a production, a performance?
Mm-hmm. It depends on the ballet. Sometimes we'll start in October rehearsing the ballet, and we won't perform it until March.
Wow.
So when we did Swan Lake, it was such a huge ballet, and it's a smaller company. It's 35 of us doing a four-act ballet. So we are all in a lot of different parts, and it takes a lot of practice to get it perfect for the stage, you know, the lines and everything. So it depends. And sometimes we'll learn things in 3 weeks, and then the week later we'll be on stage performing it. So it really depends on the ballet.
And Molly, are you doing this 12 months a year?
No. So a valley season is always off, generally off in the summers. So our season runs from October until June, and then we're off for a little bit.
And
so it's not the whole year.
And then what does that mean to Molly Flippin when you're off? How do you behave? How do you perform? How do you train? How do you eat? Mm-hmm. How do you live?
Yeah, so it's very hard when we're off because we need to maintain the same, you know, shape we were in when we were in season, but it's impossible because we're now rehearsing 9 hours a day. So it's
right.
very hard. So basically I cross train, I still take class. The company has a school attached to it, so I go there and take class the same shape. And I also teach a lot. So during the summer I really focus on teaching ballet. I teach all ages, so that for me helps income and also staying in shape, and it's something that I absolutely love and it's been a passion of mine. But it's hard. You have to maintain everything when you're in the summer because when you come back, you start the first day, you start one of the, you know, very difficult ballets, and it's all day, and so you're basically thrown back into it. I spend a lot of time trying to maintain as much as I can.
So when you come back in October, do you have to try out again, or you've got a contract and it renews? And I mean, what happens if you come back out of shape or overweight or injured?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we come back and they'll see us in class, and they really, it's the heart of the first day you come back because they're really analyzing you and how you look and how you're dancing and everything. But they will evaluate you probably the first week, and they'll put you in certain parts and see if it's going to work or not. So first week's usually trial and error.
So
but
it sounds like
contact.
There's pressure all the time. You have pressure to maintain your physical appearance, pressure to maintain mm-hmm. your athleticism, pressure to do the part, pressure to keep the part, pressure for auditions, because obviously mm-hmm. because the 35 of you are in the company, you don't know what roles you're going to get. So you have to have that additional scrutiny as well.
No, absolutely. And that's the hard thing about our job is every day we walk in, we're being, you know, they're watching us very closely and intensely, and you can never get comfortable. You can't. It's very competitive, and there's always pressure, you know, when you're on stage and they have these huge reviewers coming in that can either make or break the company, and mm-hmm. you know that, and you're going out there, and it's pressure, but you know what? That's why we have that training from such a young age and going to these summer intensives, and you're auditioning it when you're 12 years old. You're experiencing the type of audition that you experience when you're in your 20s looking for a job. So it's the same exact type of audition. So you really, it's great training, and it really prepares you for that experience. So I think all of us handle pressure very well and thrive on it too.
So we have just a couple minutes left, Molly. Mm-hmm. What do you think you'll be doing 5 years from now and 10 years from now? How long do you see yourself performing professionally?
I see myself performing. I mean, I want to go until my body can't handle it anymore. It's very, very difficult on your body, but I do a good job of taking care of myself. And hopefully another 5-10 years, we'll see. After that, I definitely want to continue teaching and possibly open a studio. And there are many, many things I could be doing with it. But I have some more years in me for performing for sure.
And what is the average age span, if you will? Like, when are you washed up?
Yeah, when are you too old? I mean,
yeah.
You're a ripe old age of 30, usually. I mean, 30 to 35, some people in my old company were dancing into their 40s.
And, really?
Yeah. So it really, really depends on the person, and you never know how your body's going to handle it. It does wear down your body a lot, unfortunately. So it really depends. I'd say usually mid-30s is when people tend to retire and move on from it.
Just like soccer players, right? David Beckham was old.
I know, exactly. And he's a young guy, but
yeah.
in that He's old.
Exactly. Yeah. Molly, thank you so much for your time and for taking the curtain aside and letting us see what the a day in the life of a ballerina is all about. We appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. It was great to talk to you.
You too. Continued success, Molly.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good morning. Molly Flippin, she began her ballet training at the age of 7, and here at the age of 25, she's with the Los Angeles Ballet, now in her third season. A great homegrown story. This is Maria Sanchez bidding you adieu. I hope you have a fabulous day and a wonderful weekend. And as always, we look forward to visiting with you first thing Monday morning at 9 o'clock Pacific. Thank you for joining us.
Give you something to talk about.